welcome back. I think many of you out there, and certainly around the world as well, not just people living in the U.S., have noticed over the years how NASA has conducted itself. NASA was, in the beginning, basically all German enterprise. German technicians, German engineers, German scientists. Operation Paperclip. I think all of you are very familiar with that by now. The first director of NASA was Dr. Kurt Debus, 1962 to 73. He was Hitler's director of rocketry at Peenemünde all during the war. His number one was Wernher von Braun, who came over here to become NASA's chief scientist. And Debus ran the program. There were a lot of very, very powerful people here, all Germans. And one of my friends and your friends, while he was with us, Clark McClelland, worked at NASA for 36, 37 years, something like that, as an SCO, a science officer. And his job was to teach the Apollo astronauts, not the Apollo astronauts, the shuttle astronauts, after the Apollo missions to fly the shuttle. He did that on the ground. He ran them through their techniques and all the protocols. Well, Clark got to know the Germans very well, and they actually accepted him pretty much as one of their own, and they trusted him. And he got to meet people that supposedly were dead, but they weren't dead. They were over here. Anyway, Clark told me quite a few things off the air and on the air over the years I knew him, well over 20 years. And one of the things he was making quite clear often was that the Challenger disaster, he said that was sabotage. He's not saying who, but he said that there were things done there that were not errors necessarily and mistakes. And though that said, and he lost a very close friend on that flight, that said, NASA has made a lot of mistakes, a lot of blunders, famous and infamous, as the guest booking says. Ken Schwartz is back with us tonight to talk about that. His father was involved with a lot of very eclectic and esoteric advanced science. He grew up in that background and knows quite a bit about a lot of things. Hello, Ken. Welcome back.
Oh, glad to be back.
Yeah. NASA, when the German influence began to wane in the 70s, these guys were getting older by then. You know, it had been 30 years after the war. And they began to retire and drop out and so forth. And the we'll call it the Anglo influence became pronounced in NASA. Was that the beginning of a lot of these mistakes you want to mention? Because I don't think
Germans were
pretty much prone to bungling like some of the things we're going to talk about. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think so. Well, one of the things that being the head of NASA became like a politically prime job to have because it had a lot of prestige.
Sure.
So what would happen is people who had a lot of political pull would get that position, but they really weren't qualified scientists or even good managers. And so with the low quality of the top management, everything, you know, like they say, as they say, the fish rots from the head down, and right. So did NASA.
Well, where is it today?
It's pretty much in the dumps. I mean, look, they got to have Elon and his rockets, or Jeff Bezos and his Blue Origin, fly the stuff to the space
station. They're doing launch work. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They can't, or the Russians do it, actually. They're the ones that do most of it. And so it's NASA can't even produce, like, a rocket. And Boeing, you know, they were going to have that... that one, I can't remember the name of it, and they spent 10 times as much as Musk or Bezos, but Boeing failed to make a spacecraft which would actually get to the space station safely.
And, it was supposed to be a space plane, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, they lost.
Supposed to take off and fly up there. Yeah.
So Boeing, because Boeing couldn't do it, even though they were spending 10 times as much. They it doesn't matter how much money you spend if you don't really have the structure of qualified people to make things happen.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So it is a little embarrassing to see SpaceX, and then Bezos will be involved with a lot of this stuff. They're privatizing a lot of the public aspects of NASA, the supposed public aspect. It's supposed to be a public agency, remember that. Part of the government, serving the people. No. Okay, how about some of these mistakes that you mentioned now? Let's go through a few.
Oh, my dad had been, he was in with the Apollo mission, the first, even before it started. He was he was the Air Force rocket expert, and they built the Apollo first stage, but it didn't have enough thrust to get you to the moon. It needed 4% more thrust, so he was sent there to help out, you know, Wernher von Braun. He'd sit at a table, there'd be like, you know, 12 Germans and him around it. And so they were working on it, and he went to like Wernher von Braun, he looked at the first stage, and he said, this just looks like a bunch of V8s, you know, or V2s stuck together and strapped together. And then Wernher von Braun said,
you're talking about the Saturn V?
Yeah, the Saturn V, the first stage. Mm-hmm. And he said, that is exactly what it is.
Oh,
and,
how funny. How interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they just scaled up. And the problem, actually, my dad really didn't solve the problem that got us to the moon. They'd been working for like 6 months, and one time they were doing a test, and one of the pumps, the drive shaft broke. So it was just spinning free in its housing, and they got 7% more thrust. So they just cut that pump out, put a straight pipe in, and they went to the moon. So that's a little story of how that overcame that one technical hurdle. So it was by accident, not by planning.
Huh. I wonder what caused the pressure to drive the fluid through where the pump used to be.
Rocket thrust going out the back also creates a pull. So it just kind of self-regulated.
I wonder how that would have affected the V2 program. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, probably would have done better, but you know, they were just doing what they knew, and they just discovered by accident there was another way.
That's funny. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's good. Providence, as they say, stepped in and reared its head. So there they go.
Yeah, but then there's been some. Yeah, there's been some negative ones, like, you know, the famous Apollo 13 where, you know, that oxygen tank blew up and they barely
give us your version of 13. That remains a little bit of a convoluted story. I don't have ready and easy access to it like I should. Go ahead.
Yeah, my dad knew the guys there, right? So they were still working there. He'd moved on to do other things by that time, and because he was just in there to help him get that one hurdle over. And so he talked to one of the guys later, and what had actually happened is that particular oxygen tank was up on one of those pallet racks, like up on the seventh level, the second level. And so some forklift operator, you know, picked it up to move it, you know, down to take it away. And while it was being taken off the pallet rack and moving down, it fell off the pallet.
Boom.
Yeah, onto the concrete, and then they and they looked at it and they said, "Oh, it looked good to them," and they just put it back on the pallet and it went off to be assembled into the Apollo 13 capsule.
And that's the one that blew.
There's a lot of piping inside of that you couldn't see from the outside, and that's actually what damaged and caused it to blow up. And I think it was into the 90s or something the early 2000s when that actually leaked and what really happened. And then later NASA came up with a story saying, it had actually fallen 3 inches.
Right? Oh, sure.
So they had to admit that it happened, but they wouldn't admit the magnitude.
Well, 13 was very lucky that it survived. That's cutting it awfully close.
Yes, that was quite a,
wild. All right. Look. When you have so many subcontractors and jobbers involved with this stuff, things happen. They just do. That's human nature.
Oh yeah, quality control. You've got to have that level of precision from the top to the bottom. You just can't have just a couple of perfect great guys at the top. It has to be an organizational efficiency.
Right. And exactly.
And then there's a few others that were pretty notorious that are much more well known. And I think one of them is the Mars Polar Lander. Or no, the Mars Polar Orbiter. Let's talk about that one first.
Okay.
And I can't remember exact year that was fired off, but it was designed to go to Mars, and then it was going to aerobrake into the atmosphere. And that would slow it down so then it could get caught in an orbit. And what had gone on is that, Lockheed Martin was the principal contractor that built it. And Lockheed Martin was always going through periodic absorptions of other companies, so there'd be mass layoffs and stuff. And so what happened at the time is you have, you know, really a couple of really old guys hanging on, the department, you know, the department heads hanging on to get the last little bit of retirement. And then a lot of wet behind the ears kids that, you know, fresh out of college, they'd hire. They were a lot cheaper. The mid quality people often were flushed out. And so what it was is they were coming to Mars and they were going to put in the burn, right, to catch the atmosphere just right. And JPL was the, JPL was the one that was going to do that. And because they're the ones actually flying the spacecraft there. Or putting
what I meant was they were going to try and slow it down to have it catch the atmosphere. I didn't mean
exactly.
You should slow down.
And so the JPL guy calls up the guy at Lockheed Martin. I'm like, this guy's a really, really old guy, right? And everything back in the day that they used to do was in foot pounds, which is how much it takes, how much energy it takes to raise a pound 1 foot.
Right.
Whereas in the young guy at JPL, everything he had learned was the metric system, where which is a newton, which is how much energy it takes to lift a kilogram 1 meter, which is a whole lot more than a foot pound. And so the guy at JPL, or the guy at Lockheed Martin, told the JPL guy the what thrust he needed to put in foot pounds. And the JPL guy didn't understand. He was telling him in foot-pounds and not in newtons, so he just punched that number in. And they don't really know what happened. They don't know whether it's, you know, the Mars polar orbiter bounced off the atmosphere because it was at the wrong angle, or it caught the atmosphere and burnt up. And but it didn't happen. And so that was a classical failure to communicate, I guess you would call it.
Wow, that's interesting. Not a big headline story either. So the Mars Climate Orbiter, 1999, $125 million spacecraft, was launched December 11th, 1998, to study the Martian climate. So it was all about metric as opposed to the old school language. Simple.
Yeah, and that was just...
failure to communicate. That's boom, end. Wow. All right, that's a good one. So what's $125 million, right? No big deal.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit here, a little bit there. Eventually it does that, add up to some real money.
10 months to get there, and they screw up like that. Well, all right, that's wild. It is quite interesting, though. I still go back to the current rovers on Mars, and how they were able to bring them down. If you've ever watched simulated videos of those landings, it's really quite a feat to get those things down like they did, these rovers.
Now,
and the Curiosity is... Go ahead.
That part of that is they can't really calculate Mars gravity correctly with the mathematics they have. And so they had to come up with all of these other ways of getting it on, like, you know, they had the little bouncing balloons, and they had... the drop thruster that would, slow it down. So, and that was kind of part of the problem.
Well, the question I have, who's cleaning off the solar panels on the Curiosity rover and the others?
Oh, that was Dust Devils.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, it was interesting. They studied it. They, you know, because what they did is they'd see these dust devils come, and a couple of them went over the rovers, and then they calculated the thickness of Mars' atmosphere.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, the speed of the dust devils that could be in there, and there was no way that could possibly pick up the dust off the solar panels. But then they went and they studied actual dust devils on Earth. And what it makes is that spiral thing makes what might be called a coherent spiral of matter. And so what happens is all that matter coherently spiraling actually causes a big negative charge at the top of the dust devil,
right,
and a super powerful positive charge at the bottom of the dust devil where it hits the ground. And, and it was actually that huge positive charge that was lifting the dust particles off the solar panels, and it's actually that positive charge is what's lifting a lot of the dust and dirt when it's on Earth. It's actually not the strength of the of the wind, it's actually like an electrostatic attraction. Mm-hmm. And so it just positively charges, pulls the dust and the rocks off the ground.
So
and also that kind of happens in tornadoes.
All right. So you're comfortable with that. How do you explain the bottle of Windex that is sitting there?
Oh, well, that would be that'd probably be in the studio if such a thing was there.
All right. I don't know. That I understand what you're saying. It's a good explanation. I still think we have people up there right now, and have had for quite some time. I think we have people on the moon too.
If they needed help, that would be if they had people up there, that would be a good thing. And you know, right. They've also had sabotage on a lot of Mars probes. And
that goes back to what Clark told me about some of the shuttle missions. They had sabotage. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a Mars probe. I can't remember the name of it. If I researched, I'd find it. And it actually was, they'd taken it out, and they'd had the rocket set up, and it was sitting on the pad, and they had a hurricane come by. You know, it didn't hit exactly there, but it was pretty, you know, it was pretty strong, so they couldn't launch during those really, really strong storms. So after it was all over, they decided, well, you know, they better make sure that everything's okay in the capsule holding the Mars probe. And when they opened up the capsule, they found it was, like, full of dust. Like the dust you get if somebody was swept up the floor and dumped it in there.
Oh, they didn't clean it. I remember this.
No, it didn't. It wasn't that it wasn't cleaned. It's somebody had purposely dumped a bunch of dust into...
Like a whole dustpan full of dust, and it wasn't checked after
that. Exactly, it was a sabotage thing.
Yeah.
And in outer space, without gravity, it would float all over and could easily damage the electronics and destroy the space probe. And
Soviet
spies? Discovered that. Yeah, only discovered that by accident because that hurricane had come by and they'd opened up the capsule. But, you know, that's a pretty serious failure when you can get some sort of saboteur can get right in there and put the dust inside because it's one of those clean rooms where everybody has to be in the, you know, the white outfits with the masks and everything.
Uh-huh.
It's super clean, but obviously a spy or a saboteur of some type was in there and was actually put that dust in the capsule carrying the probe to destroy it.
You always got to have a janitor, right? Or two or three.
Yeah, so you got to wonder. Yeah, and all that stuff is monitored. You know, they have cameras 24/7 and all that kind of stuff. So
unlike the White House, which they claim they have no surveillance cameras and can't find out who left the cocaine there, so they stop the investigation.
Who could possibly?
Who
in the White House? Yeah, exactly. They just covered it up. Yeah, who in the White House could possibly be using cocaine? I couldn't imagine somebody would come by who uses cocaine at the White House.
Who were they hunting for there?
Yes, exactly. They didn't find whoever they were hunting for.
No. Nor are they going to. And if it'll come to the point where, on his last day of quasi-coherency, he'll pardon himself and his son. He'll just pardon him. That's what he'll do. He'll say, this is a witch hunt. I'm not going to have my son but made him a victim by these crazy people. I'm pardoning him. So anyway, I'm pardoning myself too.
Yeah, I guess. Well, it's something they could do, but it's just so. Yeah, we could get down there, but it's just getting so corrupt now. It's other countries are just laughing at the United States, you know, because the United States used to go around and tell people how they have to have democracy and fair elections, and so they can't do that anymore because all the other foreign countries just laugh at them because, you know, even third world banana republics have if they steal elections, they do it with more savoir-faire and skill than what happens in the United States, which is just kind of just fist-handed and brutal.
Right.
It's just ridiculous. And not only people that believe that anybody believes elections in America are fair are, you know, some Americans, because everybody else in the world knows they're totally corrupt.
Well, those and the dead who still vote, they believe it too, I guess.
Oh yeah, there's always the dead vote. They were voting back in Kennedy's day, you know.
They threw the election to JFK. That's the word.
Yep, that was from
Chicago.
Yep.
You know, very good. Okay, well, these are kind of fun stories. The story of the incineration of the three astronauts, Gus Grissom and I can't remember the name of the other two, but they burned up in the capsule, one of the early capsules.
That was just sheer idiocy.
That's what I heard.
Yeah, because what actually happened was they'd been working on there, and an engineer had left a pair of pliers, or mm-hmm. the guy's wiring, had left a pair of pliers inside the wiring there. They'd just forgotten them. But what they did is they just had the gas was convenient, so they pressurized the whole capsule with 100% oxygen.
Boom. Wow.
Yeah, and then, you know, you turn something on, there's one spark at 100% oxygen. Well, yeah, there it is. It's all over. I mean, they could have used just regular air, but I guess maybe it was cheap and easy because they had an oxygen bottle around. So let's just pressurize it with, you know, this pressurized oxygen than, you know, doing nitrogen. Because they were in spacesuits. They didn't need to breathe the air in the capsule. And that was just sheer idiocy. Why anyone would pressurize something with pure oxygen is just, with electrical stuff in it, is just insanity.
No, I agree. That was a very unpleasant event among several. All right, onward. By the way, a lot of these things that Ken is talking about, there are many more that he can't talk about because they've been hidden. We don't know. They cover things up, I'm sure, like any big corporation does in the public eye. They'll cover them up anytime they want, just like the cocaine in the White House. Covered up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's and then there was another one, which was the Mars Polar Lander. But that's more with their failure to be able to calculate gravity. And it's kind of part with the Newtonian gravitational formulations, because the way they actually don't, you know, what Newton did is he basically took the whole planet, all the volume and mass, and put it into an infinitesimal point at the very center of the Earth. And then he theoretically did the same with the moon. And then from that one point to the Earth, you could calculate, you know, gravity between, say, the Earth and the moon. And it's a really useful mathematical perspective, but you know, there is some cost to that, because a perfectly spherical gravitational field comes off that infinitesimally small point, the point mass, but the Earth isn't perfectly spherical. It's a little wider at the middle because it spins, and shorter at the poles. So if you try to use a strict Newtonian method,
it's throwing its weight out. It's right.
Yeah. It doesn't work. And so what they do on Earth is they just have this fitted average curve. It's just like they give a base and then they add like a curve to it. It's not based on any physical parameters of the Earth. It's just kind of like something they slap together that isn't very accurate, but it gets the job done. But if you go to someplace like Mars, Earth is 0.3% oblate, whereas Mars is 0.5% oblate. And if you were trying to do like a fitted curve from Earth on Mars, it wouldn't work. But when it came to the Mars Polar Lander, all I could find with NASA, which later disappeared from the information that was available, is they were actually using like a straight Newtonian calculation of gravity to land near Mars poles in the Mars Polar Lander, which is a little bit off of what actual gravity is. Gravity is actually a little bit less than that straight Newtonian method.
Okay, right.
And so, so when they sent the Mars Polar Orbiter or the Mars Polar Lander to Mars, what they did is they, you know, it came into Mars. It had aerobraking, and then the aerobrake slowed it down. And then they when it got to a certain aerobrake, you know, the heat brake went away, and a parachute popped up, and that slowed it down further. And then when it was about 4 kilometers above the surface, the parachute kicked off, and then they had like a program burn of, you know, retro rocketing into Mars for about 4 kilometers, and then somewhere 10 to 20 meters above the ground, the terminal guidance kicked in, and that would guide Mars Polar Lander to the ground. The problem is if you're let's say 0.5% off on a 4 kilometer burn, instead of, you know, being 10 meters above the ground when your terminal guidance kicks in, you're over 100 meters above the ground. Oops. And they don't really know what happened. Did it exceed the, you know, the parameters of the computer programming in the Mars Polar Lander, or did the Mars Polar Lander just run out of fuel trying to get down to the Mars surface? But anyway, it crashed. And then that's why they lost the Mars Polar Lander.
Got it.
They've lost landers on the moon and other landers on Mars for that same reason, that inability to calculate gravity. But But I used
hold,
to
hold on,
I used
Ken.
To go to,
hold hold on. What? I got to stop here. We have a little break. We'll come right back and continue our conversation with Ken Swartz right after this. Okay, welcome back. Talking with Ken Swartz about NASA and other things as well. All right, any other events you want to mention? We really do want to talk about your dad and this Genie missile test. That's very interesting.
Oh, yeah,
I've looked at the video, and pretty wild. Genie missile.
Yeah. Well,
people
other,
don't know this. Go ahead.
Yeah.
That's 1957.
Yeah, back in the day. Before I was around, by the way. So, what it was is you know, they had the Mars Polar Lander, and it of course, crashed. And there was another one that they were going to do. It was called the Phoenix Lander. It was the exact same platform, exact same technology. And they were going to send it to Mars, and, of course, it was going to crash. But fortunately, I used to go to the Mars Society back in the day, and I knew Dr. Peter Smith, who was the chief scientist or project manager on the Phoenix Lander. So I wrote him a letter and showed him that, you know, that NASA was using the wrong calculation of gravity. And actually, I think it was 2000 or so, I had developed a new set of gravitational formulations when I was doing my master's thesis, the retention of magnetic fields and rotating terrestrial planets to the actions of a close large orbital partner. It basically showed, you know, what causes the magnetic field in terrestrial planets. But when I went to get to use some mathematics for doing the gravitational whistles and bells, they're really, the Newton system didn't work, and the fitted, you know, because it's perfect in the fitted one. So after that was done, I actually came up with a set of mathematical formulations. They're actually three times more accurate than Newton's for calculating gravity, let's say, on the oblate Earth or the prolate moon, or maybe even landing on a kind of an odd-shaped asteroid. And so I sent him the mathematics, but I don't think he actually used them in the Mars landing for the Phoenix lander. But what he did do is he changed the protocols for the lander. So what he did is, instead of like when the heat shield was there, then it kicked off and the parachute was on, when the parachute kicked off, he made sure that the radar altimeter and the flight computer were hooked together. And from the very second of the retro rocket, you know, firing, they tracked it all the way down to the surface. And that's what allowed Mars Polar Lander to happen, for the Phoenix Lander to happen when Mars Polar Lander failed, because he just changed the parameters. Of course,
so
if they
you
used
did
my
it,
mathematics.
But you showed him the way, and he followed it, even though he didn't
and that's
want
why,
to.
Yeah, that's why it worked, because, yeah, he just did basic, basic. He said, well, he didn't believe that, you know, JPL could be so bad at not being able to calculate gravity.
Right.
But, you know, he made sure that, you know, his baby, he would have the very best possibility. So it was tracked that whole that 4 kilometers down, and it landed successfully. And,
well, congratulations. That's quite a feat.
So that saved him, like, $300-something million. Not that I got a thank you, but at least, you know, we did get a lander on Mars. I think the Phoenix lander is actually the one that saw, like, water and ice on Mars' surface. So,
wow.
Which was interesting
fun
to see. So,
where was this Mars club or Mars meeting group?
Oh, it's the Mars. It's the Mars Society or the Mars, and they meet every year. It's like a little conference. And sometimes I'd go there. I mean, sometimes we'd sit and talk with, like, guys that work, you know, behind the scenes. They'd talk with, you know, the Grays would come by and visit the shop, you know, over a few beers. You'd hear all the stories.
Oh, really?
Of, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yep. Little people working with, let's say, certain defense contractors and other things. So you know,
okay,
that's at the bar.
Just for our listeners, there are many, many stories, many accounts of ETs, little Grays, and maybe some others, who interface with the advanced secret echelons of the U.S. military, which runs most everything. And that's kind of common. And these guys used to talk about it. How interesting.
Yeah, well, getting into the alien story, I guess probably I could talk about the Genie missile.
Yeah. Well, the Genie missile was an air-to-air missile that would be under the wing of a jet fighter, just for example, to show everyone what we're thinking about here. It's an air-to-air missile under the wing of a jet fighter. Okay.
And yeah, And it had a 2 to 4 kiloton atomic warhead on the tip. And allegedly,
doesn't that make it an air-to-ground missile?
No, it's an air-to-air missile. And allegedly, they were to shoot down Russian bombers. You know, you could just fire in their general direction.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But we're going to get a little bit more onto that. But let's get to the story, because my dad was like the Thor missile expert. He was the Air Force missile expert. And so they had problems, but he also did all kinds of top secret stuff for the Air Force. That was basically his job. But he got called in because the GE missile had always been, the project was running and it kept getting sabotaged. So they figured that maybe he could fix it because he'd done stuff like that before. So stop getting sabotaged.
Ken, I have to ask you, hold on. Was your dad friends with a lot of paperclip scientists? He must have.
Oh yeah, he knew Wernher von Braun and all those.
Yeah,
other
you mentioned that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, he knew a whole bunch of those guys.
Okay.
He didn't talk too much about it, but yeah, he knew them.
Got it. All right.
So anyway, they sent him in there, and it had been being sabotaged. You know, he figured it was the commies, you know, whatever type it was.
Yeah.
And so what he set up, the plan was he was going to have two missiles. There would be like a. One missile would be like the public missile, where everybody would see and know it's happening. It would be kind of out in the open. And then there was a second missile being built, and it was in a room that my dad only had the keys for. And so when the scientists would work and get the first missile, you like get the part in and get it all working, then they would secretly go later into that room and do the same thing. And since they'd done the practice on the first one, they did a much better job on the second one. And so that's kind of how it all proceeded until finally it was like the day before they were going to launch them, do the test. And, of course, my dad knew this is when, you know, the sabotage is going to happen because he'd been in the security and done stuff. And so what they did is they had, like, the bait missile, which was the first one, and the second one was being protected, extra protection, you know, guards and stuff. And
actually had to build a decoy.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
and
the
so,
sabotage was that bad. Interesting.
Oh, yeah, and they didn't know where it was coming from, how it was being done. And so what they did is they had that missile like on top of several pallets. It was like sitting there on top of several pallets. And he had tape and all kinds of stuff everywhere. Do not touch. Do not come here. Do not do this. You know, everywhere.
Right.
So
right.
But it was kind of the bait, right? So he had the security was just a little bit lax in that area. So it'd be like a tempting target. And what happened is one of the workers there who was, you know, worked, quote, in the warehouse. He was, you know, ran the pallets. He said he needed a pallet for something he was going to do. Right. So he went there and even though the tape was there, he took it all down and then he was going to lift the missile off and put it aside so he'd get one of the pallets underneath. This was the explanation. And of course the missile fell over and got broken and damaged. And then, you know, the general comes in and he says, he didn't tell the general that was running a thing was going on. The general says, my career's ruined. The missile's done. And my dad says, no. That was just like a show missile. This is the real missile. And he took him to the room where he only had the keys. And there, of course, the intact missile was. And you'll probably have links where you can watch it on YouTube. My dad flew a wing on that test because he figured a bunch of the idiots at the project, they actually went down to ground zero because they fired it off, you know, miles above in the atmosphere. And a bunch of guys down were on ground zero. But my dad was flying wingman on that launch. But
what kind of a jet was that? I looked at the video. What kind of a jet was
that? I can't remember.
Flying?
It was the one with I can't even remember the name of the jet. It's I'm sure a good aeronautics guy would recognize. It's one with the wing tanks on the end of the on the end of the wing, which makes it more aerodynamic. But what it was is, you know, they obviously this guy. They decided what they were going to do, right? Obviously, the security sees this guy. And you can believe that they did, what are they? Probably enhanced interrogation techniques, right? and so they worked this guy over. They studied everything. And they couldn't make, they could not understand why he did this, right? But there's another explanation for really what happened. The security guys, he wasn't associated with the commies. They had no, it was like, you know, somebody had like took over his mind and made him go do this.
Okay.
Because there was no explanation.
It's a parallel program to MK Ultra. That kind of, it's mind control.
Or something or else. Because what you see, the excuse was the genie was made. They made 3,000 of them, right? 3,000 of these air-to-air nuclear missiles. Mm-hmm. Right. And but the problem was the Russians didn't even have 100 bombers. Right. So why are you going to make 3,000 missiles air-to-air nuclear missiles when the Russians don't even have, the Soviets don't even have 100 bombers.
Now, just keep everybody up to speed. These were missiles that were not designed to actually hone in on a particular aircraft, just get near them and light off this nuke.
It's because it's hand grenades and horseshoes and nukes, you know, you have to be as close. And actually, the Genie missile was designed to take out alien spacecraft, flying saucers, so to speak. So it was actually a missile designed to fight, you know, UFOs. Uh-huh. And that's why they made 3,000 of them, so they could send them all over the place, and they could, if there was an alien invasion, they would have a weapon that they could fight back with.
Wow.
And, you know, maybe even some of those spacecraft that crashed, maybe, you know, Genie had something to do with it. So,
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's actually why they made the Genie. And, one of the things we haven't talked about the small heads. And that group of people that like hang out in Italy and other places, but it really looks like what happened was that they were basically one of those people that worked at the facility had been basically taken over by, you know, butted up or something, mind controlled by alien influencers, who then were trying to sabotage the project, which was designed to make a weapon to fight off, you know, UFOs, alien spacecraft.
How interesting. Parallel program and hidden in plain sight.
So anyway, at least in that case, it was Humanity 1 and Alien 0. And so the Genie, eventually the Genie missile got canceled by McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
And McNamara did a lot of other bad things. I'll bet you if you dug up his worthless corpse and looked inside of his skull, you'd find some alien mind control technologies still there. Somebody out there. Mm-hmm. You want to find out some? Yeah, you get. It's probably an older model, but you could still get the alien mind control. Because I think there's a serious problem on planet Earth of you know, highly advanced alien mind control of, you know, bots, but even in understandings we don't have that have actually infiltrated a lot of the leaders. Because in a lot of these systems, all you got, because you know the small heads used to be able to operate in the Soviet Union without any problem. So. I suspected they had mind control potted the Soviet leaders, as well as many of the leaders in the West. Because if you can just control the top few, you can kind of control the whole nation. And, you know, and that's really the reason that they've never, the UFO thing has never, the alien presence has never been brought out. Because, you know, about 2 weeks after people realize that, you know, there really are aliens, they've always been around, they're going to figure out that the aliens have been controlling and running their society for centuries, if not thousands of years.
Right.
And it's kind of hard to overcome and fight an alien occupying oppressor if you don't even know that aliens exist. It's kind of a little hard to do resistance if you can't even understand the fact that you have a problem in
That's the first psychological wall of defense to keep people from figuring it all out.
They just deny and deny.
Okay.
Yeah, and so people doing the denying that are forcing that down your throats, guess who runs them? It isn't your friendly humanoids.
I got it. When Ken says the small heads, he's talking about a certain species of people from elsewhere, and they're tall, 7, 8, 9 feet, I don't know, and their heads are more or less of the proportion of somebody who's 6 feet tall. They're smaller.
What they do is they have a technology that extends the lifespan of mammals like us. Because a lot of these small heads are actually humans that have been recruited, and, you know, if you give you all the money, and it allows them to basically have eternal youth. Well, at least for centuries and centuries. But one of the side effects is it kind of reactivates the growth plates on your bones. So you kind of go into a crocodilian growth mode. So every year you get older, you get a little bit taller and bigger. And that's with crocodiles. The bigger the crocodiles, the older it is. And so when you talk about the small heads, you know, the top guy is like, you know, he's about, I don't know, 10.5 feet tall. He's the oldest. Then some of the second in charge are like 8.5 feet, 8 feet tall, and then there's the 7-footers, and there's a 12-footer that comes by every now and then. And all these, and you know, we don't see in our societies hierarchy by height, right? But we have a lot of examples in our society of hierarchies by age. And because of this life extending technology, which allows them basically to have eternal youth, you know, they just get bigger and bigger as they get older and older. So the tallest guy is the oldest guy. And then the second tallest is the second oldest. And so it's a hierarchy of age. And so, and we could probably talk about the small, but pretty much all extraterrestrial species have this technology. It's very simple. And actually I was kind of involved in some of that research, but I stopped doing that because pretty much anyone who gets involved in that research, you know, they get their funding pulled. And if they still keep doing it after their funding pulled, they have unfortunate accidents.
Got it.
So yeah, it's no, one they, of those they, things
they,
you don't
they,
want
they
to research.
They delete people all the time.
Yeah,
that's something. That's
yeah,
not
they will.
Under,
yeah,
understood.
You will not. Yeah, and yeah, and you're looking. I could tell stories with Trevor James Constable about, you know, how the level of saturation and how they can learn about things that, you know, they should not have any way to do it. They basically have taken remote viewing to like the next level. Imagine taking remote viewing with technology, and so you can basically see what's going on all around the world. Even if you think you're secret and doing it by yourself, they can actually kind of see it, what's going on. It's like taking remote viewing that we know it and take it like a magnitude more. And, you know, and that's kind of how they control the population.
Yeah.
So it's just a level of technology and manipulation that just goes way beyond anything, you know, even humans have even thought about.
Very interesting. By the way, for you Dick Allgaier fans, remote viewing, Dick will be with us next Monday. And he's got a lot of interesting things to show. We're already uploading the images right now. So that'll be fun next week. But yeah, look, here the deal is, we are not only not alone, but we are subservient to one or more of the so-called visitors who may have been here as long as we have or longer. So you figure it out.
They basically act as mafia. They're like mafia groups to each other. You know, it's pretty brutal. There is Breccio wrote a book. It's called The Italian Case, Friendship Case.
I've heard of it.
Azealia,
yeah.
I can't say that Italian word. I don't pronounce Italian. But it's Breccio guy wrote the books. You can go online and buy the book. And there used to be stuff on YouTube. I made him take it down. But you can buy the videos. It was a very famous UFO case. It's called Friendship in Italian in Italy. And you can read about that. It's, you know, he was there. You know, they had, it was what really went on and what happened. You know, years later, he wrote another book. I didn't pull it off my shelf to tell you it. But yeah, that's something if you really want to, you might want to go look into.
Interesting story. I mentioned David Jacobs the other night when George Filer was on. David, I think his most recent book is They Walk Among Us. And he makes the point that they're, you know, they can pass. They're right there.
Yeah, that's like the Mantoid Gray group.
Right.
Who battle out with the little heads. And then the little heads battle out with a couple other groups. And so there's like, you know, it's very complicated and
it's
hierarchical.
Like a bad, so it's like a bad soap opera.
Think about it. I mean, as so above, so below. And so, you know, imagine you're like some third world country during the Cold War era, where, you know, you'd have American agents influencing that country. But there'd also be like British agents, right, who kind of work with the Americans, but they do their own thing. And then, of course, there'd be the Soviets trying to like influence that third world country to get it to go in the Soviet sphere. But then also you'd have like the communist Chinese would be there, right, trying to do their thing. So and then throw in some big corporations that are just there to make economic gain, but which are associated with one of the other groups. And that's kind of the way it is in the bigger sense. It's kind of the same basic principles apply, just in a larger sense, as so below, so above. So if you can kind of understand the way things worked in the Cold War and all when everything was all struggling, and just, you know, imagine that in the cosmic sense. And now it gets you kind of, you get you in toward the direction of truth.
Very good. Interesting. Well, there's a lot going on this planet that the average person will never understand. I don't see any ultimate disclosure about this whole thing. I mean, why? Why would they even bother? They've carried it off for so long now. They've got it their way. So, and they're now in the world business of population reduction. So, all the more reason to sit on it. They're just not going to let it out. They let a few things out. That's all.
Yeah, what
did you think of Grush? Seemed very credible.
Yeah, I think they're, it's just like that and the stuff that Stephen Greer has out and his people.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's, I mean, no, that's all there. I think it's there, but it's just that, you know, they're never going to give you disclosure. They're never going to give you, you know, the truth. They'll give you a lie. If they ever give you something, believe me, it'll always be a lie.
Well, you summed it up perfectly. Very good. Thanks, Ken. That was fun. That was a very good little tour of some interesting highlights. The genie.
Well, glad to be on again.
Ear-to-ear missile. Yeah, well, we'll do it again. You take care and be well.
Yes.
Okay. Ken Swartz. We'll be back tomorrow. Gosh, it's Friday already? Wow. Let us see. All right. It is Friday. Father Paul Kramer tomorrow, among others. Okay. Have a good night. Have a good day tomorrow. Thank you for being here, and we'll talk again tomorrow.